This is tape recording number 6102-309-3SA-ACC-11. Lecture 11 of the 3rd South African ACC, given by L. Ron Hubbard on the 9th of February, 1961. The title of this lecture is Mental Healing, Sanity and Insanity. It is 60 minutes long. Copyright 1961 by L. Ron Hubbard, All World Performance Rights Reserved. This recording has been re-recorded by HCO Tape Unit, St. Hill Manor, East Grinstead, Sussex, England.
Thank you. This is the 11th lecture, 3rd Joburg ACC, Thursday, 9 February, AD 11. The whole project of trying to ease up somebody's psyche has occupied quite a bit of attention down through the years. There's some chaps used to fool around with knuckle bones and feathers and try to do something for people. Wasn't very successful. Down in Australia, why, they had a magic healing crystal, and all they had to do was go flick-flack with that, and somebody was supposed to recover. The American Indian medicine man, he liked acrobatics. Matter of fact, I've seen him do some very remarkable things, be in the middle of a wigwam, and all of a sudden be sitting on the lodge poles up at the top of the wigwam. Flip! You know? Do it so fast, everybody would think they had suddenly appeared, and then magic voices would come from the top of the wigwam, you see, which was dark, and the fellow was now missing in the bottom of the wigwam. Very interesting, but it didn't do much for people's minds. Well, back in Egyptian times, I, like maybe some of you, played around with the scalpel and the various equipment of the Egyptian healer. Got down to a point finally where you're just trying to do something for somebody's body. Dickens with the mind, you know, but you couldn't do anything about that, so let's just kind of try to alter the anatomy somewhat. Greek tradition, Hippocrates, the rest of these chaps, they were worrying about the tides and humors of bodies and so on, Galen. Just do something for the body, you know, just patch him up so he isn't walking on one leg or something, you know. A really apathetic look at it. What you probably don't realize is that medicine is a decayed interest in the mind. And that's why I say to you, and Scientology consistently, knock off the healing. Knock it off. Physical healing. You don't belong in the field of physical healing. The reason I say you don't belong in the field of physical healing, it is a decayed interest in the mind. Now, down through the Middle Ages, of course, they were mainly depending on demon exorcism. One of the most learned texts I've ever read is the proper standard operating procedure for a demon exorcism, which was in use for about 1,000 years by some outfit, some small group. I don't know, the Vaticanism, I think this thing is called. They had a complete textbook on the subject of how you exorcise demons. And it's a very thick textbook, and it's very learned. And, wow. Actually, you would think offhand that this was something they took from Christianity. It isn't, however. It is something brought over from Arabic healing. And the Arab was the demon exorcist. He was pretty good at this. And the Western cultures picked it up. Matter of fact, we get most of our mathematics, herbs, surgery, so forth, from the Arab. And we picked up demon exorcism right along with it. And it was a very religious activity, however. No matter how hard they fought the infidel, they were still using his demon exorcism. Well, there's all kinds of odd bits and branches of learning. You someday want to become very learned indeed. Why, pick up some of the elementary texts of these things. They're extant. They're not really very complicated. And they are very simple for a Scientologist to understand. You'd laugh like mad, matter of fact. He goes along, yes, yes, yes. Actually, they're not comprehensible unless you know Scientology. It's a very interesting reverse look. I'm often intrigued about somebody suddenly understanding, you know, some Lamaism or something, you know. Funny, I read that years ago and I didn't understand a word of it. You know? And he's read an understanding into it that isn't there at all. It's just a potpourri of nonsense, you see, but he aligns a few facts along with what he really knows is true, and all of a sudden it seems to make sense. Well, that's fine. But anyway, here's this vast sea of disrelated, unimportant, contradictory, clashing facts, which makes a vast confusion on the backtrack. And when you start looking at the particularities and the very, very, very complicated explanations for such things as insanity and illness and so on, you sort of feel like you're just going adrift on it. Well, now, all of you have lived on the way up this track, and all of you at some time or another have collided with these problems on the whole track. And as you study Scientology, these confusions tend to run off to some degree. And the more fundamental a truth, why, the more confusion is liable to be set off by it. Trying to learn the axioms, for instance, is a very tough bullet to chew. Just for that reason. But after you've learned the axioms, why, you find you've blown off an awful lot of confusion. The learning of the axioms is specified so that you will blow off that confusion. One actually doesn't care if you know the axioms. It's just certain that if you can quote the axioms verbatim, you haven't got an awful lot of the confusion you did have. You know, trying to teach the axioms to an HPA student is quite interesting, and that he'll just have it letter perfect for a split second, and then somehow or another it fogs out. Gone. And then it inverts, and then it does this, and then it gets back on it again, and writes a dollar, and now you got it, you know. 10 o'clock at night, you know them all down from 1 to 10, cold. 9 o'clock the next morning, something's cold, but it isn't the axiom. It's just a method of blowing off confusion. An old-time Scientologist actually would profit by just going back and reading them all the way through about a dozen times. And you'll get some more residue blowing off. Quite interesting, just the address of truth. All right, so you can get a clarification of the backtrack to a very marked degree about all this, but certain fundamental questions still exist. And one of these questions is, what sickness? Another one of these questions is, what's insanity? Another one is, how do you cure sickness? Another one is, how do you cure insanity? These are awfully fundamental reaches. There is a much more important question than what is the anatomy of insanity? You know, what is it there that goes insane or something like this? Particularity, just this blunt question. Well, what is this thing called insanity? Well, you can give a lot of fancy definitions, for instance, of what insanity is in Scientology today, and they'd all make sense. You could say, well, just picking one out of the hat, insanity would be the total inability to direct any intention. It'd be a total inability to direct any intention. At the same time, there'd be some automatic intentions directed, but they're not being directed. You could say this, you could say that. You could say that sickness, for instance, is the germ theory of disease. A fellow by the name of Pasteur. By the way, I wonder if Professor Wundt in Leipzig, Germany, ever knew this. Pasteur was supposed to be one of the brilliant minds of the 19th century. Possibly one of the, if not the most brilliant mind. Professor Wundt in 1879 declared that all thinkingness was the brain. You see, the brain did the work. You know, it figured everything, and it looked at itself, and it mirrored itself, and it controlled itself, and it was a marvelous thing, this brain. He got this all doped out. This, of course, would follow naturally upon a total failure of 2,000 years of trying to control or do something with the soul. For 2,000 years, everything was going to pieces because nobody could do anything with this thing called the human soul. You know, they had it going to heaven and going to hell and being good and being bad. And basically, nobody's doing anything with it. So the natural consequence of this, of course, would be to say, well, it isn't there. Pooh, skip it, you know. It's a brain. And that's how psychology came in the back door. Anyway, in 1870, Pasteur's germ theory of disease, developed by the great brain called Pasteur, is followed by a very interesting fact, which is totally contrary to Professor Wundt's most hopeful thinking. I don't say Professor Wundt was the fellow who brought about the maxim. If the fact doesn't fit with your theory, throw it out. Basic. They do that in psychology all the time. That's why they don't make very much progress. The theory is precious, you know. Well, I can think of a billion theories. Theories aren't precious to us. But you'll find people around in the field of research that they'll think they'll get this theory, you know, and boy, that theory is really precious. You know, that's the last thought they could possibly think, that theory. You know? And there it is, and along walks up some contrary fact and sneers at it, you know. And they promptly pick up this fact and dump it in the nearest wastebasket. And this today is getting more and more scientific research. The unwanted facts. Various reasons why this happens. Sometimes these facts are against the principles or against the policies of the university in which they arise. So that's a good enough reason to throw a fact out. Communism, for instance. Well, this fact is contrary to Lysenko's theory, so therefore it doesn't exist. That's how not to make progress. Well, anyway, getting back to Pasteur, when he died, he willed his brain to science. When they took the axe to the skull and removed the brain, they found out that one entire half of Pasteur's brain was completely withered. He had operated his whole life on 50% of a brain. So much for Professor Wundt's theories that the brain does it all. Interesting, isn't it? Yet nobody in psychology has ever mentioned that. Because you see, the stable datum is the brain does it all. And yet here was the greatest mind, one of the greatest minds of the 19th century. It was only half there. So anyway, it would be very serviceable to you to have some kickoff point for these two ponderous questions, because these two questions, of course, have stirred up a tremendous amount of research back through the years. Now, practically every reason why your witch doctor, your medicine man, the surgeon, the priest, all of these fellows, the reasons they existed is because such things existed as sickness and insanity. They would see behavior that was on optimum, and they would pronounce that insane behavior to try to do something about it, you see? But they didn't know what it was they were looking at, and they didn't know what to do about it. And so we'd get various schools and activities that tended to suppress the thing. It's interesting today that psychiatry has not moved beyond the Asclepian of Greece, Grecian times. The Asclepian administered a shock. The idea was that the epileptic is holy. And so if you can just make an insane person into an epileptic, something interesting will happen. That's actually the whole thought. I mean, these thoughts look so incomplete to you that you don't credit them, and you automatically add things on to the end of them. For instance, the reason they do prefrontal lobotomies is because a blacksmith one time in Bavaria, these interesting things always happen in Bavaria, had an assistant. This blacksmith's assistant was an idiot. And a forge blew up, and a crowbar that was sitting in the forge blew out of the forge, and a point of it entered one side of the idiot's prefrontal lobes and went out through the other side. And it went clear through his prefrontal lobes, and the idiot went on living. That's the total background. Now, it didn't make the idiot sane, see? It didn't make him smart or anything like that. That just happens to be the total background of the prefrontal lobotomy in surgery. There is no other background. You say, that's incredible. Why would anybody... Well, that's just incredible, that's all. But the Greek administered something he called hellebore. And hellebore threw people into a fantastic convulsion. And that's what they're doing today with the electric shock. They're doing it because the Greek used hellebore. Actually, that treatment is better than 2,000 years old. And it's not changed yet. If you throw a man into a convulsion for some reason or other, it sometimes happens that he comes out the other side not as crazy or as not as much bother to the society as before. In a certain low percentage of cases, you get something that even looks like a cure. It dwindles and disappears after a little while, but it looks interesting, you know. That was the best they could do. That's treatment about 2,000 years old. Electric shock, as even a psychiatrist will tell you, he doesn't know this. He isn't good at his history. But he'll try to remember on this thing, and look it up and find anything. Oh, that's right. You have to produce a shock. That's what we're doing with the electric shock machine. We're trying to produce a convulsion. And you say, why? And he says, well, to produce a convulsion. You idiot. So in the face of all this ignorance and incompetence, it appears to be even insouciant or impudent for us to suddenly come up and say, well, we know what insanity and sickness are. Well, if you knew these things completely, and if you could announce them as total tied-up facts that admitted no slightest variation from that point on, of course, you'd have it very made. Well, I can only tell you a series of sickness. Sickness is what happens after somebody doesn't want to live. That's what sickness is. Sickness is the consequence of desiring not to live. That's a theory. disease as a special brand of sickness is the automatic mechanism which rot or obliterate or bring to dust the body, triggered while the person is still alive. In other words, they decide to die because life isn't worth living, and then they can trigger one of these decaying mechanisms one way or another, and away it goes. See, if the Pasteur theory was correct as far as germs were concerned, then everybody would die from the germs. And unfortunately, this doesn't hold true. The facts of the case are that only a certain number of people will be susceptible to a brand new illness to which they have never had any chance to become immune. The great plagues of England. Now, that was a brand new illness to that genetic line. And yet it didn't kill everybody. Well, that's what's astonishing, because nobody knew what it was, and fleas and lice were everywhere. And everybody got bit. And why didn't they all just die off? You see, for a scientific fact to be a fact, it has to be an invariable fact. So that means that everybody would have a susceptibility to a new bug, and they don't. That's very interesting that you'd find immunities without any excuses for immunities. Why is it, for instance, that, well, let's take a very unsavory subject, venereal disease. Why is it that only about 80% infectiousness comes out of something like that? It's not 100%. And why does the same bacteria produce more effect on one body than another body? This is also an interesting variable. There are quite a few variables here. The first variable is that the bug doesn't kill everybody. And the second variable is it produces variant effects upon various people. And the other bug is that the antidotes and antibodies and so forth of bacteria immunize variably. For instance, the first 100 cases of smallpox that were entered into a military hospital at the beginning of World War II had all been vaccinated. I mean, if these theories were good and these activities were good and they were certain, why, then you'd get something approaching 100%, but you see, you don't. There's all kinds of variabilities keep occurring along these lines. Well, in view of the fact that most medical activities are apparently a decayed interest in the mind, we'd have to look back to the mind to find out how these things get triggered. And we'll find out that a person does not get ill unless he's already decided to chuck it up. Quite interesting. They didn't want to be here anymore, and then they get sick. Well, that's invariable. Now, in yesteryear, lacking research tools, people would not have been able to have found this out. They didn't have this thing called knee meter. They didn't have Dianetics, Scientology. They didn't know about time track, engrams, lock, secondaries. They didn't know a lot about these things, you see. So they wouldn't have been able to found this out except to ask somebody, well, if you decided not to live, this fellow's very sick, you see. And they decided not to, oh, no, I want to get well, Doc, I want to get well. They'd say, well, obviously, you see, obviously the fellow didn't want to die. Well, the fellow wanted to die, all right, and later on he regrets it, but he's already fired off the concatenation. Too late. And you just look at anybody that's sick, and you go on down the list here of questions you might ask him. And the question that'll really kick the thing, have you ever wanted to die? In this lifetime. Not some past life. Oh, my. Oh, my. It starts in about the age of 5 most of the time. They run into things. They don't think they can make it. They think life is going to be too rough. Something of the sort. So they decide to do a bunk. Well, they're not permitted to directly do a bunk. That is to say, this bug got into the line. In order to leave this body, I've got to kill it. That's the primary aberration then. That's not true at all, you know. But in order to leave this body, I should kill it. The gentlemanly thing to do, or the ladylike activity, you see, is not to leave half a live vegetable flying around. You get them every once in a while. You go down to the hospital, any hospital of any size, there's somebody in there where the body is just vegetating. Satan has done a bunk. They call it coma, various things like that. Now, your first consideration, then, of illness is death. And because you can't kill a body off directly, it's not done, it has to be done covertly. And there are many trigger mechanisms which destroy a body, which cause it to rot and decay and so forth. Well, these trigger mechanisms look remarkably like illnesses of various kinds. They follow along certain patterns and so forth. And evidently, the effluvia of one of these illnesses can re-stimulate it in another body to some degree, but only if the effluvia is already re-stimulated in that body. You get the idea? I mean, there's got to be an agreement here before there can be a decay. Well, it would be an interesting research for somebody to go down the list of all the illnesses there were and find out what type of body decay each one of these was. But in view of the fact that an engram can be utilized, an engram can contain any type of injury, the person can bring the engram in against his body and start it to work, then you get a new multiple of illness, and you get these tremendous numbers of illnesses which can't be cataloged or classified. And there are tremendous numbers of them, as any medical doctor can tell you. He tries to get out from under one way or the other, and then he'll abandon by saying it's psychosomatic. But it's interesting that he said it was psychosomatic, because until we came along, he never had any proof that it was psychosomatic. There was no faintest proof for psychosomatic illness until Dianetics and Scientology appeared on the scene. You look it over, it's true. To have declared it psychosomatic, they would have to have demonstrated that it was curable by mental therapy. And they didn't cure things by mental therapy, so how was this? This was just another theory. It was interesting that it was a true theory that could be demonstrated, but nobody had demonstrated it until we came along. All right. If illness is a method of disposing of a body in its final state, then obviously the cure of illness would consist of the eradication of the impulses not to be here. The impulses not to be here would be eradicable only if one took the charge off the painfulness of being here. So in order to make somebody well, so that he'd stay well, I'm afraid you'd have to straighten out the mind. Now, there are certain illnesses which will surrender to antibiotics and other cures. And that word cure is used very advisedly. But the antibiotic is dwindling in its effectiveness. And it's one of the greatest worries of medical science today, the way antibiotics go out. Of course, basically, they're being mishandled. Very few medical doctors know how to administer them. This began when they first appeared and hasn't been remedied since. They give too little, too infrequently, and antibiotics have to be written right up on top of the exact amount for the exact place and so forth. But the antibiotic arrests the cycle of action. And sooner or later, that cycle of action is going to complete itself. They're going to knock out the bugs. That's right. But then the cycle of action is going to complete itself. Maybe today, maybe in 10 years. But you stop something from happening that would ordinarily have gone out to a completion, and it'll sooner or later go to a completion. That doesn't mean necessarily that a person is going to get sick and perish from that illness, but it does mean that it will go the rest of the stages. There'll be some obscure fever suddenly show up 8 years afterwards. And the person will have this fever for a little while, and nobody quite put his finger on what the thing is, and he'll have some painfulnesses here and there. And you could trace those painfulness back to an illness that was cured by an antibiotic many years before. Hennekin is the first boy to put his finger on this about a century ago, and he's in the field of homeopathy. He founded that particular field. And he didn't know anything about the cycle of action, but you read his stuff, and with what you know in Dianetics and so forth, you can patch it the rest of the way up. And it's obvious that he says there that things have to complete their normal course, and that things that are grossly interrupted or stopped in the completion of their normal course will hang up and cause difficulty. That's a very interesting sidelight on the cycle of action and illness and disease. When you cure it, anything less than or anything short of curing up the basic mental cause of it, why, it's going to finish up sooner or later. Why? Because it's usually contained in an engram. The fellow has slapped an engram up against his face, you see, and he's carrying on through this engram. And now the antibiotic does something weird and peculiar to the engram. As a matter of fact, most antibiotics take all the B1 out of the system, and people start having nightmares and things like that. Well, that's just a way of scrunching an engram down. It's a method of making one ineffective, you might say. And it's interesting that what an antibiotic does is suppress the creativeness of bacteria, according to theory. That's very funny, you know. Now, basically, all you'd have to do is suppress anybody's creativeness and the bacteria would fold up. The suppression of creativeness will always result in some kind of a cure. Like telling somebody, look, you never created anything, you can't create anything, God created everything. The person suddenly and mysteriously get over his leprosy. What's this, you know? Well, actually, the only person that's there to keep the leprosy going is the guy. And if you tell him he can't create a cotton-picking thing and prove it to him, of course, whatever he's creating, he'll stop creating. Of course, he's in terrible shape now, but we won't pay any attention to that. We cured his leprosy. The whole subject of healing can only be indifferently done if approached mechanically. It's indifferently done. Sometimes successful, sometimes not successful. It has various side effects that poor this way or that, or there's something goes on. And the healing really doesn't entirely occur, you know. It's like setting somebody's broken leg. You don't ever really cure a broken leg. Not unless you run out the traumatic aspect of the broken leg. And then, of course, it heals quite rapidly and does cure and does get well and he does get over it. But how thoroughly you ran it out would be the test of how much the fellow got over the broken leg. After the broken leg is set, the only decent thing to do to anybody would be to run out the incident in which he broke his leg. That would end the cycle of the broken leg. But just setting it sets him up for trouble. Sooner or later, why, he's going to have rheumatic pains and little things this way and that way, and it's not going to be all right, and the circulation in the area is going to get bad, he's going to get arthritis, and you get the idea. something else happens here all the time. When we try to fix these things mechanically and pay absolutely no attention to the mental aspect of it in any kind whatsoever, we have additional side effects which are undesirable, and therefore curing or healing cannot occur. It's not true that you as an auditor, finding a fellow with a broken leg, should audit it out as your first action. That's not true. You should get it set. And then audit out the incident and the setting of it. That's proper handling. Fellow's bleeding from the femoral artery. Why, don't do a touch assist. Chap drowning. Why, don't run out the engram of drowning. Do some artificial respiration fast. Emergency actions can be done and should be done. And medicine is, to a marked degree, an emergency action. It doesn't always finish it all out. The only thing wrong with medicine, by the way, is it just takes up too much territory. It's pretending to take up the whole sphere of healing, and it is not capable of doing that. It even pretends to take up the field of insanity, and it doesn't belong in that field. Medicine belongs in orthopedics, obstetrics, emergency first aid, perhaps over in the fields of physical hygiene, something like that. But when it goes any further than that, it gets immediately into trouble, and its eventual disgrace will come about because it's pretending that it can do things which it can't do. Medicine is only in a very poor way handling bacteria right now, and I'll give it another 10 years, unless some very inventive biochemist has come up with a brand new type of antibiotic, medicine will be finished. They've pretty well forgotten what they knew about it yesterday, you see. And they've been dependent here for a couple of decades on antibiotics. Now think of what happens here if the antibiotics suddenly don't work anymore. And they're not working. They're working less and less. People are more and more allergic to these things. They're less and less functional. Well, sickness is a deterioration brought about after a decision to die, which is not to be here, is reached. And you don't get sickness when somebody wants to be here. Now, he gets sick, and then he... It's true that the individual himself has adjudicated these things. He has been influenced, of course, by counter-efforts which he himself is holding in suspension. A great many factors go up into this, such as the whole reactive mind, the engrams, all of the basic laws on which people operate. All these things enter into this, of course. But first and foremost, and most fundamentally, the person has decided not to be. He decided he couldn't be. And then reversely, he's decided that he can't directly not be. So he's got to do it covertly. He's got to slide out somehow. And he won't be guilty of his own death. That's the one thing he must never be guilty of. And of course, nobody ever killed anybody but the person himself. You run enough death engrams off of a person, and sooner or later he's going to come up with this as a private realization. He's in any kind of shape at all when you start out with it. I have never been killed. Never. I have only killed myself. If all you do to a person is to make his present time plus his future apparently totally without hope, there's no slightest hope, anyway. You'll have at least a sick person on your hands, and probably a neurotic or insane one. Really takes some working, you know, to do that. So there's no possible hope in present time or in the future. Just convincing that it's, well, as long as you hold on to that body, there's not quite, there's right now, there's no happiness for you, there's nothing.
And out into the future, there's no chance at all because bodies just deteriorate and things get worse. And that's it. Now, if he can convince himself utterly that you're right and this is true, and he triggers up enough on this line, why, he'll get sick. Look at every serious illness that a person has had. Or more elementarily, look at any accident a person has had. Do you know that you can trace it back on the e-meter a matter of hours or days or weeks or months to his decision to have that accident? You know, you can find the decision to have this perfectly accidental accident. So on the other hand, that a person can be in or and do in and have in an environment, interest and so forth, and that he can have a future, this all by itself can go bang and surface. A sudden environmental shift can suddenly change the health aspect. But it's not to be relied upon. Some great doctor in the United States found out that the best cure for something or other was to inherit $1 million or something like that. That was very perspective of him or something. Truth of the matter is that an individual wants really to go on and make a line of it, but at the same time wants to, because of the hangover, wants to die and not make a go of it when he is ill. That is what he is doing. He is not making a go of it, making a go of it. He can't kill himself outright, so he's doing it slowly. He doesn't see there's any possibility of being there, and yet he has to be there. And all these conflicts. It's a create-counter-create situation, and out of this you get both illness and insanity. And I hope sometime when you're bucking into some of these things and you're going through all of the processes, certificates and so forth, if you're not getting along as far as you think you should get along, please, why, step back a foot or two and take a look at the thing and realize what it is and remember what I've told you in this lecture. Thank you.